Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. In Christopher Hitchens' What He Got Right, How He Went Wrong, and Why He Still Matters, published by Zero Books in 2022, Ben Burgess reminds readers about what was best in Hitchens' writings and helps us gain a better understanding of how someone whose whole political life was animated by the values of the socialist left could have ended up holding grotesque positions on Iraq and the war on terror. Ben Burgess is a Jacobin columnist, an adjunct philosophy professor at Morehouse College, and the host of the YouTube show and podcast, Give Them an Argument. I'm so glad his book has brought him to our program. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you so much, Salvin.
So to get started, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Yeah, so I was reading Christopher Hitchens a very, very long time ago. I can remember being like, I don't know, 18, 19, and in the late 1990s and reading the Nation, you know, the actual Dead Tree, you know, print edition of the Nation with his Minority Report columns in it. And, you know, even then I didn't necessarily agree with him about every single point, but I always found something really compelling about his writing. He's somebody who drifted off my radar for a while. I was kind of vaguely aware of what he was saying, but then, you know, he kind of had this, in terms of my experience of him, you know, this kind of second act in the 2000s, when he became the sort of one of the most prominent faces of like public atheism in the United States. He would, you know, he would do debates with, you know, pastors and rabbis and priests, and, you know, and I, he kind of came back on my radar through that. I remember through all this time, like, you know, I'd see him in, you know, Slate magazine, for example, places like that. He's always somebody I found fascinating that, you know, when he was saying things that I agreed with, I think nobody ever said it better. And even when he was saying things that I disagreed with, you know, he did have this kind of magical power to make me want to read him saying things that I really disagreed with or even abhorred in some cases, and to even do it in such a way that, you know, as I was like reading it every once in a while, oh damn, he actually has a good point about this part. And he's somebody who, you know, like there's a lot of, from that last period of his life, there's a lot of the evidence of that scattered around YouTube. You know, you can still find quite a bit of that. And he's somebody I'd find myself returning to over the years, you know, because I did find something really, really compelling and kind of magnetic about the presentation a lot of the time. And I would find myself thinking back to him and like reading his old books, you know, over the years. And my hope leading up to reading this book is, as you kind of alluded to before, he's somebody who spent the vast majority of his life on the left in a complicated, ambiguous way. I didn't entirely leave it even at the end. But he took these positions that I hate, you know, on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, most obviously. I think a lot of people, a lot of sort of left writing about Hitchens, a lot of left reactions to Hitchens, at the time, you know, and even when he died, you know, we're sort of understandably colored by that, you know, the sort of resentment of that break, you know, was still really fresh. And my hope is that since I was writing this, you know, right around 10 years after he died, that would be enough time that had passed, that sort of feelings about that would have cooled a little, and people would be ready for a reassessment of the guy, that we could sort of look back, you know, without quite as much of an emotional filter of, you know, how people might have felt about some of the positions he took in his last 10 years, and see, hey, there's this body of work here that's really interesting, and what can we learn from it, and what's good and valuable and holds up, and the stuff that doesn't hold up, what can we even learn from how that happened?
Right. So for listeners who are not familiar with Christopher Hitchens, could you tell us a little bit about his background and his political orientation?
Sure. So Christopher Hitchens grew up in England, in a naval family in England. His father was a commander in the British Navy, and sort of upwardly mobile middle class family, more or less. There's a story that he tells in his memoir, Hitch 22, about at a very young age overhearing his parents arguing about whether they could afford to or whether they should, you know, send him to what in Britain, oddly enough, are called public schools, but like private boarding schools, right? His mother saying, well, if this country is going to have a ruling class, I want Christopher to be part of it. But he goes off, he goes through that system, you know, that sort of elite private school system. He goes to Oxford. He probably, I have to say, benefits throughout his later life in the United States from having a sort of Oxfordy British accent, because Americans are very impressed by that. But while he is around the time he starts at Oxford, he becomes a committed socialist. He was already by this point a member of sort of the youth wing of the British Labour Party, the sort of mainstream like moderate left party in Britain, and he was very against the war in Vietnam, and he was sort of vaguely sympathized with like the left wing of the Labour Party, but he's recruited into this group called the International Socialists, which would later become the Socialist Workers Party in the UK. And the important thing about these people is that they're Trotskyists, which means that they're people who were on the side of the Soviet dissident communist Leon Trotsky, who lost a factional struggle in the Soviet Union and was eventually assassinated. And these people, there are sort of range of views amongst people who come out of this tradition, but these people have a perspective, the International Socialists, on the Cold War, where they say a pox on both your houses, that, you know, both sort of Soviet style authoritarianism and Western corporate capitalism are both bad, and they're not interested in taking sides in that conflict. And so they say neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism. So that's the background that Hitchens comes from. This is, remember, the mid to late 60s, when people, many, many people felt like there was sort of revolutionary tumult going on around the world, and who knows what could happen, where it could all lead. You have things like in the same year, a general strike and student uprising in Paris almost overthrows the government of Charles de Gaulle. And at the same time, on the other side of the Iron Curtain, there's the Prague Spring, which is a sort of experiment in a more humane kind of socialism in Czechoslovakia that's crushed by Soviet tanks. And so if you are a neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism guy, you could feel like you're really something important is crested and you really might be on the cusp of some kind of world revolution. By sometime in the mid-70s, it's pretty clear that the revolution isn't happening anytime soon. Young Christopher, like many people, sort of gets tired of going to meetings all the time to argue about obscure factional things. And so he sort of moves out of that. But he retains his sort of basic socialist commitments for decades after this point, even as he becomes a much more mainstream sort of journalist. So he works initially for a magazine called The New Statesman in the UK. And then at the beginning of the 1980s, he goes on a exchange program where he went to work for The Nation in the United States, and somebody from The Nation went to work in The New Statesman in the UK. Christopher decides he likes it in the United States. He wants to stay. They give him a permanent job at The Nation. He spends a lot of time over the course of the 80s writing about things like the crimes of Henry Kissinger, who will come up again, I'm sure, very soon, and the sort of right-wing death squad dictatorships that the United States is backing in Central America. This is sort of the beat that Hitchens is on at The Nation. In the 90s, he writes this sort of famous hate trilogy about these figures that he really despises, who are the aforementioned Henry Kissinger, Bill Clinton, and the one that really sounds odd now, which is Mother Teresa. We'll get into it.
Why don't we stop for a moment there? So in 19, that was very good, very, very helpful kind of background, setting for Hitchens' life and work. So in 1995, Hitchens writes a book titled The Missionary Position, Mother Teresa in Theory and Practice. And
that had a flair for titles.
He really did. And I read it and found it fascinating. And the first thing that surprised me was that the popular perception in America, at least, of Mother Teresa is, even before she was canonized by the Catholic Church, was that she was, literally a saint. She's this beatific, wonderful person that's helping all these poor people around the world, especially in India. So what was Hitchens' problem with Mother Teresa, of all people?
Yeah, right. Of all people, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it is funny, right? Because, I think bits and pieces of this I knew even at the time, but there, nevertheless, I know there are times over the decades that even I've slipped into, if I'm sort of conversationally reaching for an example of a extraordinarily good and self-sacrificing person, I'll be like a Mother Teresa. And because it's so culturally embedded, right? That's the picture of this person. But he paints a much less flattering picture in the book, I think, very accurately. I think he's got her dead to rights. And one thing, because I mentioned earlier that Hitchens later, in the 2000s, especially the late 2000s, would become known as this sort of kind of one of the world's most famous atheists, and do these debates with clergymen and all that stuff. Given that, and he's like, okay, he's writing a book about Mother Teresa, who has since become a saint. You think this is going to be an anti-religious book, or at least an anti-Catholic book. I mean, it's Mother Teresa, and it really isn't any of those things. not really. I mean, like there's a bit where he's sort of bringing up, and it's certainly a negative from his perspective, the way that she consistently sides with the most kind of right wing fundamentalist faction within the Vatican on issues like, you know, birth control or the ordination of women, or, you know, or acceptance of gay Catholics, or, you know, et cetera, right? But, you know, these are the complaints that a liberal Catholic might make, right? Like, this is not like he's not really interested in going after her theological views, except insofar as they impact her behavior. You know, he's really, what he's really interested in is her politics and her practices. So a lot of that book, like, it opens by talking about Mother Teresa sort of pallied around with and lending her aura of moral authority to the Duvalier dictatorship in Haiti, which don't want to get too sidetracked on this, but I mean, like, is really probably one of the most despicable governments on the planet, you know, at the time, you know, that the if you try to organize a labor union in Port-au-Prince at the time he's writing about, you know, then, like, very likely, you know, there'll be pieces of you found at the side of the road, you know, because the death squads chopped you up. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about here. This is baby Doc Duvalier at this point. The Papa Doc was the father, and she's saying, you know, she's saying, like, oh yeah, my friend Duvalier is a great friend of the poor and all this stuff. It's like, okay, and there's a lot of that, and there's a lot of hypocrisy. She actually crusaded against liberalizing the divorce laws in Ireland, for example. But then, when her friend Princess Diana was getting divorced, she's like, oh, it's probably for the best. You know, it's like, okay, you know, which is it, right? and then the really gruesome stuff in that book is that, you know, she was accepting money from all over the world from people who thought, well, they had the mental image of Mother Teresa that I said earlier. They you know, that it's like she's out there devoting her life to the most desperate people in the world in Calcutta, which is not entirely wrong, but is very misleading. People would assume, you know, like, if they're donated to her, I mean, even though she, you know, to her credit, she never said this, but that they would be, you know, like, she's operating these hospices in Calcutta, that they would be, like, going towards people's medical needs. And as a matter of fact, that money overwhelmingly just went into religious missionary work, and the actual level of care that was provided for people at the hospices was pretty barbaric. They didn't use, you know, modern anesthetics. That, in fact, she seems to have had these kind of gruesome views, like suffering brings us closer to God, you know, and I think, it's a very good book. It's a very short and digestible book, but it's not pleasant reading.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite, chilling to learn about the reality of how Mother Teresa's, institutions actually operated in Calcutta, how she actually viewed these very poor, very desperate Indian people, and all of the religious aura, as you say, and all of the religious charisma that people you know, associated with her, how she used that in very, very problematic ways. So thank you for that. Moving along on the trilogy, Hitchens trilogy that you mentioned. So in 2001, Hitchens wrote a book. We skipped one. In 1999, Hitchens wrote a book about President Clinton, No One Left to Lie To, The Triangulations of William Jefferson Clinton. And again, obviously, there were many many conservative, politically conservative voices who were criticizing Clinton, and there were also maybe some liberal voices. Was there something distinct about Hitchens' critique of Clinton?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also worth putting this into some context about the time in which he's writing it, because for anybody who's listening, who does know a little bit about American politics as they are in 2023, it's a very different landscape when he's writing this book, because this, you know, in 2023, you have much more of a separation between, a kind of resurgent socialist left that comes out of the two campaigns by Bernie Sanders for president, that, you know, is associated with various members of Congress, that there's like there's the magazine that I work for, Jacobin, which is kind of the most, you know, maybe the highest profile sort of outlet of that. And there really wasn't anything equivalent to that in the 1990s when Hitchens is writing this book, which, you know, I'm emphasizing that because criticizing the Clintons as harshly as he did from the left was actually quite unusual at that time. I mean, like when there's a sort of clear separation between like liberals and left liberals and socialists and all of that stuff, it wouldn't be so surprising, you know. But when Hitchens, even at The Nation, you know, which is where I was, you know, the Nation, I think, is probably, I don't know, always, but, you know, for a long time, you know, had a slightly ambiguous political identity that it sort of hovers somewhere between mainstream liberalism and something more radical and left wing. And so you could have somebody like Hitchens, who was still very much calling himself a socialist and all of that, who was writing for them. And he's certainly not the only one. But even at The Nation, a lot of people, I think, probably on a day-to-day level, felt a little defensive about the Clinton administration, because American politics as it existed then, you have, you know, like you alluded to, you know, you've got the right wing, you've got people like the, you know, this very famous right wing talk show host at the time, you know, Rush Limbaugh, or like the sort of far right Speaker of the House of Representatives, you know, Newt Gingrich, you know, who are sort of out there all day, every day, attacking Bill and Hillary Clinton. And, you know, oftentimes I think it's kind of inevitable that people see, the people they hate the most in the world attack something, often, and, you know, often for unfair reasons even, and feel some kind of sense of attachment, you know, to the object of that attack. But Hitchens, perhaps coming from this British socialist perspective, was less weighed down by that, and I think had a clearer view of the subject. And it's a brutal book. It's my personal favorite of his books. And for a lot of reasons, but it's really the one where there's the most. One thing that makes it interesting in terms of this sort of overall Hitchens oeuvre is that so much of his writing about politics is really about foreign policy. You know, what wars the United States is fighting, what governments it's backing in other parts of the world, and there is definitely some of that in the Clinton book, but this is relatively rare as a book where he really brings a lot of his rhetorical fire, a lot of his moral force, to thinking about domestic politics, to thinking about economic inequality. One of the things he really nails Clinton's on early in the book is this alleged attempt that they made at healthcare reform in the early 90s that was really not at all what it was presented as being. And very early in the process, you know, Hillary Clinton, who was like taking point on that health reform task force, was, you know, told by like the Physicians for a National Health Plan, look at these polls, that there's all this public support for having a single payer, you know, Canadian style healthcare system where, you know, it would just be tax funded and, you know, you wouldn't have to, it'd be like the fire department, you know, nobody, when the fire department comes to put out your fire, they don't say, you know, they don't like wait for you to swipe your credit card first. this is how healthcare should work, and there's all this public support for it, and the math works out for the taxes and all that stuff. And she was like, yeah, no, right? You know, that's we're not going to do that, right? You know, they're not going to alienate the, you know, the big health insurance companies, who were actually, contrary to a lot of later mythology about this, the biggest healthcare companies were actually like enthusiastically supporters of what was at the time called Hillary Care, you know, smaller ones generally that were like funding the ads against it. That didn't happen at the time, although in some ways it has a lot in common with, you know, Obamacare, you know, which is the sort of later healthcare reform that happened in the late 2000s, which, you know, is an improvement in certain respects, but it sort of keeps the basic edifice of for-profit health insurance that, you know, keeps people tied to their jobs. You don't want to piss off your boss because, you know, then if you lose your job, you know, you lose your health insurance. It keeps that whole obscenity in place. And so there's a lot on that. There's a lot on so-called welfare reform in the 90s where something, you know, what we used to have, aid to families with dependent children, it was called, was the old welfare program in the United States. That was eliminated in favor of this scheme where sort of individual states would kind of get to decide to do what they want with the welfare money. So anybody who might have heard of, there's the retired football player Brett Favre. There's a scandal about him just very recently in Mississippi, because he was being paid to give like motivational speeches from what was supposed to be Mississippi's welfare funds because of this Clintonian reform that they just broke it up into these block grants. There's a lot of the way the welfare reform worked was that you would have to, if you didn't want to get thrown off benefits, you know, you'd have to be funneled into this really grisly, it's called, you know, workfare system where you, which was, you know, a few steps above slave labor, but I mean, like you like oftentimes like really unsanitary, unsafe, you know, kind of work that, you know, people are willing to do under these circumstances because the only alternative is like real destitution. But, you know, we're talking about like, you know, mothers with like, you know, children who are only a few months old immediately have to go back to work and, you know, and do this stuff. That there's that, you know, he goes into some gruesome detail about Tyson Foods, which was maybe coincidentally, maybe not, a big backer of Bill Clinton's various political campaigns over the decades and a big beneficiary of workfare recipients. And we're talking about, you know, there's just this kind of Dickensian nightmare of workplace accidents, of sexual harassment, you know, of et cetera, et cetera. And not to mention, you know, one of the things that he points out very sharply in the book that, it's particularly striking because this is a time when Bill Clinton was being investigated for things like lying about a sexual relationship he had with a White House intern, which at the time the sort of prevailing liberal attitude was you know, maybe just short of Boys Will Be Boys, but it was, you know, say just who cares, right? You know, don't be a prude, which I think would maybe read a little bit differently in the Me Too era.
One hopes,
yeah. But at the time, there's all the stuff about even presidents have a right to privacy, and so he's describing these like requirements for welfare recipients under Bill Clinton's welfare reform, where people are subject to all, you know, to like searches to make sure that they're not like hiding, you know, other sources of income or like a boyfriend who might be providing income. People are, you know, are subject to random drug tests. It says it seems that only presidents have a right to privacy.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Very, very, very well said. Yeah, it's quite, again, really shocking and disturbing things about this program, the quote unquote welfare reform, which was presented as this kind of liberal solution to the problem of poverty in America, and then it turns out it's actually really just a way to save money for the federal budget and not have to raise, you know, taxes, and at the same time doing it at the expense of millions of poor people, many of them women, many of them minorities. Really quite despicable stuff that Clinton, as you say, kind of from the perspective of the mainstream media, even the liberal media, really didn't focus on these misdeeds of Clinton.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, like, one of the things that you'll find out about from that book and from some of Hitchens's interviews on YouTube, since he always brings it up, but you will, you know, you could go many years of consuming liberal media in the 90s without encountering this fact, right, is that there was a point. So Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas just before he was the president. And when he was running for president in 1992, he, you know, like, this is in the – this is a time period where, you know, politicians were really competing with each other in the United States to show who was like toughest on crime. So there's a sort of the previous election in 1988, there's this really notorious exchange where like Michael Dukakis, who's the Democrat who's opposed to the death penalty, is asked like, okay, but what if like your family was, you know, murdered and like they lay out this whole grisly scenario and, you know, wouldn't you want that person, you know, to be executed? And that was like a presidential debate question. And so for similar reasons in 1992, Bill Clinton wants to prove that nobody can out-tough him on crime. And so during the presidential campaign, he actually flies back to Arkansas to personally oversee the execution of this guy, Billy Ray Rector, who is somebody who by the time he was executed, I think some of this is because of a like gunshot accident, you know, during the commission of the crime. But by the time he's executed, this is a profoundly mentally disabled person. In fact, I believe under the later Supreme Court ruling, you know, several years too late to save Rector, it actually wouldn't have been legal to execute him anymore. You know, but like, you know, when he was executed, you know, he assumed that the doctors were there to like, you know, give him medical help, and he was like helping them find a vein, you know, for the lethal injection. You know, this is something that Hitchens was really passionate about. This is you can find, a debate that he did that's still available on YouTube in 1997, where he and Jesse Jackson are arguing with a couple of guys from the National Review magazine about the death penalty. And the former mayor of New York is moderating for some reason. It's a really strange debate, but his view is, you know, is this is like this is a kind of legalized human sacrifice. And, you know, I think at least if we're sort of interested in the kind of freeze frame of Hitchens politics at this time in the, you know, mid to late 90s, you know, when he's, 1999, you know, when he's writing this this book about Bill Clinton, you know, this is really it. He's got this, I think, entirely correct outrage about what America is like in the 1990s that you know, we're sort of out of on the one end, you know, we are, you know, we're sort of leaving people to just kind of wallow in poverty and taking away, you know, the few government supports that had ever existed, you know, in America's honestly by global standards fairly paltry welfare state. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, we're when you step out of line, you know, the enforcement is really brutal, you know, and this is and I don't know how much optimism that, you know, he really has in 1999 about, you know, having a sort of qualitatively better kind of society of the kind that he always used to advocate. Right. But he, you know, he certainly at least sees that, like, you know, this isn't it.
Right. Right. And you mentioned before that in 2001, Hitchens writes a book titled The Trial of Henry Kissinger. And again, of course, many people have criticized Kissinger over the years. Is there something distinct about Hitchens' critique of Kissinger?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, Hitchens' critique of Kissinger in that book is a very, putting it this way is going to make it sound much drier than it is. It's actually a really gripping book, but it's written in this very literally prosecutorial sort of way. Like, in other words, he is not just sort of going through everything that Kissinger was involved with that was horrible, which would be, you know, a series of much longer books. But he's really specifically, I mean, thinking about, okay, if Henry Kissinger were actually going to be put on trial, right, what are the things that he could actually be criminally prosecuted for? What are the things that we could kind of get him on that are, you know, there is sort of definitive, you know, proof of his involvement with? So he's really, you know, he's not, you know, the sort of larger thrust of the book is not sort of just kind of thinking about, you know, it's not a critique of Kissinger's policies, right? It's not, oh, you know, you supported this, which was really bad, you shouldn't have done that, or, you know, or even like, you know, you were instrumental in the United States waging some terrible war somewhere, you know, which all of which, of course, there are abundant examples of with Kissinger. But what he's really trying to do is go through publicly available transcripts and other kinds of evidence, and and find evidence of actual crimes, you know, that he that should, and this is not entirely, I mean, it sounds fanciful, and in a sense it is, because as an incredibly powerful and well-connected person, it's very unlikely that that Kissinger would ever actually see the inside of a courtroom. Although I will say, on the other hand, even now, there are several countries that Kissinger can't visit because there are actual like warrants out for him. The police in those countries would be instructed to bring him in for questioning about things like, for example, in Spain, you know, the Pinochet government in Chile's, disappearance of, you know, multiple Spanish citizens, in Chile, and what Henry might know about this, what light he might be able to shed on it. So I just mentioned Chile. I mean, this is one of the examples that, you know, you could actually find transcripts of discussions where, internal discussions where Kissinger in his various roles, I think at that point as national security advisor, I don't think he was Secretary of State yet, under Nixon, was like literally talking about assassinating a general in Chile who was not even a, you know, I guess I should say just for like 30 seconds of background to all of this, right? At the beginning of the 1970s, a democratic socialist named Salvador Allende was elected as the president of Chile, after a very brief and tumultuous term, tumultuous in large part, not entirely, but in large part because of the United States involvement in stirring the pot, he was deposed in a military coup favor of this general, Augusto Pinochet, who imposed, you know, neoliberal economic policies on Chile, with literally people like these big libertarian economists like Milton Friedman coming down to give them, you know, Santiago, to give, you know, give economic advice, and also torturing and killing lots of leftists and unionists and dissidents in Chile.
To be clear, Milton Friedman didn't do the killing. He gave the economic advice for how the government could change the economy, and then the government to keep itself in power did the killing.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I actually do very, very slightly know. Milton Friedman's son, David. I did a debate with him about capitalism and socialism once. To be clear, David, I'm not accusing your dad of killing anybody in Chile. I am accusing him of giving economic advice to a really awful person. But in any case,
terrific. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, we can continue.
Got that out of the way, yeah, it's. So in the lead up to these events, there is like tangible documentary evidence of Kissinger talking in these national security meetings, you know, in the White House about. Yes, exactly. Right. This is the Nixon White House. I'm not sure if the president is literally in the room at this point or not, but they have about killing this general in Chile who was not even a socialist, but was, you know, somebody they were like fairly sure wouldn't go along with a military coup. And that's on record. There are places, you know, and similarly, you know, you could find him talking about, you know, in these, about, you know, very specific, like, things that you could actually prosecute as war crimes in when the Nixon administration bombed Cambodia the sort of late stages of the war in Vietnam, which, you know, is was I mean we Americans refer to that as the secret Bobbin of Cambodia. I don't think it was a very secret to the Cambodians, but
you just have to look up.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It was kept secret from Americans. The instructions that Kissinger discussed with President Nixon and passed on to the Pentagon brass for that were anything that flies on anything that moves, you know, that there's like very explicit about not distinguishing between civilian and military targets in Cambodia. And it is striking, right? So I think like pulling back from some of these specifics about Chile, about Cambodia, about East Timor, where, you know, a U.S.-backed dictator, Suharto.
Indonesia.
In Indonesia, right? You know, so Indonesian dictator Suharto occupied East Timor, committed, in terms of proportion of the population, I mean, like actually the worst mass genocide, you know, since the Nazis, you know, that the as well as a lot of massacres within Indonesia itself. So pulling back from, you know, from the sort of specific, you know, hypothetical indictments of Kissinger, like one of the things that I always remember from that book that kind of frames the whole thing is Hitchens like recounted in the introduction, you know, seeing Kissinger at like I think a Vanity Fair magazine party, and even now, Kissinger's much older now, I mean he probably makes it out to parties a lot less, but he's still asked to write for prestigious journals. He's still brought on news networks, you know, to opine about the news of the day.
Hillary Clinton considers him a great friend of hers.
Famously in the 2016 campaign, she said Henry Kissinger was her great friend, trusted advisor. Every White House, Biden hasn't yet, but every previous White House since the Nixon administration has brought him in to give them foreign policy advice, and so this is, you know, in some ways it runs parallel to the Clinton example that I think, you know, you have Christopher Hitchens, who's, you know, coming from a different national context, different political context, has a little bit of an outsider's perspective on all of this, was also somebody who was, you know, deeply involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement in Britain, apparently slightly knew Bill Clinton back then. This was one of the right wing attacks on Clinton in the early 90s, that he'd gone to an anti-war protest in London. He also has in Hitchens' memoir, Hitch 22, he has one of my favorite details is, you know, at the also there's also this big deal about whether, you know, this says something about the early 90s, that this was such a big deal, you know, about whether Clinton had ever smoked pot. And he infamously tried in classic Clinton fashion to split the difference and said that he didn't inhale.
So he smoked it, but he didn't inhale it.
Hitchens's claim is that Clinton was telling the truth about never inhaling marijuana. He said he preferred edibles. but you see Kissinger at a Vanity Fair party is like, who's this, like, you know, sort of like dumpy guy with this, like, these like stale jokes who everybody's gathered around. Surely this isn't the person who's involved in, you know, overthrowing democratically elected governments overseas and, you know, in indiscriminate mass bombing campaigns and disappearances of, you know, inconvenient priests and journalists. Nope, that's the same dude.
Right. So we have to get to the kind of central question maybe in Hitchens political life and career, which is that this is someone who, as we've been speaking, and as you note in your book, you know, for decades was anti-imperialist, was against, you know, American involvement in foreign wars, you know, and then after the terrorist attack on the Twin Towers in 2001, he famously comes out in support of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq. And the obvious question is, how on earth could this happen? How could someone who is a committed international socialist end up supporting U.S. military aggression?
Yeah. How do we go from neither Washington nor Moscow to Washington after all? Yeah, right. So this is one of the big questions I was trying to answer in the book. And one of the reasons that I was interested in writing this in the first place is because it seemed to me that a lot of left-wing writing about Hitchens that kind of, especially from, as I said at the beginning of our discussion, back when the kind of wounds were at their rawest, right? That the that at their freshest, you know, that like obviously, you know, you have somebody who's in some cases a friend, a comrade, you know, has like gone off in this direction that you find abhorrent, right? You know, and you experience it as a betrayal, and you're sort of very prone towards the least charitable imaginable explanations of what happened here. It's like, oh, maybe he just liked the spotlight. Maybe he was just like selling out so he could like go on CNN more, you know, maybe an aspect of Hitchens that will be familiar to anybody who knows a little bit about him, but we haven't talked about is that the man was a fairly legendary drinker. And so you'll even see, you know, there's a hilarious video you can see on YouTube where he's being asked at some event, you know, the interviewer is like, all right, we've got a lot of questions here for people about your personal, you know, preferences. And somebody says, what would you, is the one thing you take to a desert island? Somebody else says, what's your favorite whiskey? And it's, oh, those sound to me like the same question. That's where it's Johnny Walker Black. So, you know, you even see people bringing that up, that it's like, so did he have like a lost weekend in fall 2001? And then he just sort of realized that, you know, that he'd taken this insane position and he couldn't walk it back, you know, and the alcohol just like eat his brain somehow, and like he lost his critical faculties and, you know, got him to support the war. Is it perhaps the anti-religious views that, you know, became such a big deal in the late 2000s? So did he just care too much about atheism and this made him Islamophobic? And that is what led to these positions. And for all sorts of reasons, I don't find any of this remotely convincing. I don't think that he was just pretending to have this position because somebody was offering him big sacks of cash with dollar signs on them. In fact, I think that if you just wanted to position himself in a careerist way, I think simultaneously taking the position that would most alienate his former supporters and comrades about the wars, and also taking the position that would most alienate the American right, his ferociously anti-religious arguments in the 2000s, is probably a pretty bad way to do it. I also don't think that it's the booze. I'm just being too, you know, as somebody who, you know, not as much as Hitchens also enjoys whiskey. Maybe I'm just defensive about that, but it seems to me that, you know, there have been plenty of committed socialists and anti-imperialists, who drank just as much of that. I'm pretty sure at least half of the people who stormed the Winter Palace in the Russian Revolution liked vodka as much as Christopher Hitchens liked whiskey. I don't think that's it. And even the Islamophobia, I wouldn't deny that there's an element of what you could reasonably call as Islamophobia in some of his his comments and commentary from the 2000s, that I think that you could accuse him of not making fine enough distinctions between different kinds of Islamic doctrine. Although you could also make the same accusation about Christianity, right? You know, that he's lumping that together too. And certainly I think he's wildly overestimated the realistic danger that Al-Qaeda style terrorism could pose to Western societies. If you want to call that Islamophobia, I'm not going to fight you on it. But it's certainly misguided, you know, whatever it is. It's also not exactly a unique Christopher Hitchens problem. That was kind of everybody in the Anglo-American mainstream in the 2000s. But I think the Islamophobia explanation stops making sense the more you look at the details. Because this is not actually – and I understand how it happens, right? Because somebody could maybe – they could sort of maybe vaguely remember a few Christopher Hitchens columns for The Nation. They could maybe they saw some of these books that we were just talking about, that hate trilogy at the end of the 90s, you know, beginning of the 2000s. And then kind of the next time they noticed him, he was on TV supporting the war in Iraq, and could think, oh my God, this is some kind of, you know, Jekyll and Hyde transformation, what happened. But I think if you're zooming in and paying closer attention to the details, this is actually a very gradual transformation on his foreign policy views that was already well underway by not very far into the 1990s. And one reason why that's important is that the first war where he warms up to the idea that the U.S. military could actually be a force for good in the world and softens his usual anti-interventionism is not actually one where the United States is bombing Muslims. It's one where the United States is intervening on behalf of Bosnian Muslims against Serbian Christians. And in fact, in the 2000s, even with Iraq, you know, it's his worst position. Part of the backstory of that, you know, he'd been opposed to the first Gulf War, but then he'd spent time in Iraq after that, and particularly he'd spent time in Iraqi Kurdistan. That after the first Gulf War, there was this, you know, Kurdish region in northern Iraq that was sort of managed to assert a kind of de facto independence that, you know, that it wasn't under the control of Saddam Hussein's government. There was a no-fly zone there. And
supported by American military.
Yeah, exactly, right? And he'd spent time in this Kurdish enclave in northern Iraq, and you had local leaders there who, for, you know, reasons that I think require no explanation, we're all in favor of the United States getting rid of Saddam Hussein for them. And some of these local, you know, Kurdish leaders were people who had been 1970s radicals too and could speak to Hitchens in his own language. And, you know, also, of course, you know, they really had been the victims of really awful crimes from Saddam Hussein's government. That's all true. And so a lot of his trajectory was, in fact, influenced, you know, by his time spent in northern Iraq. And in the 2000s, when he's taking these, I think, horrifically misguided foreign policy positions, you know, he often wears a flag lapel pin, and it's not stars and stripes. It's not the Union Jack. It's the flag of Kurdistan. And, you know, this is an overwhelmingly, you know, Muslim nation. I mean, a relatively secular one, but, you know, a overwhelmingly Muslim nation. So this too, I think, makes me think that Islamophobia is a huge oversimplification. So if it's not Islamophobia, it's not just selling out or liking the limelight. It's not that bottles of Johnny Walker Black should come with warning labels that they might make you support neoconservative foreign policy. then what is it? And I basically think it's two things that come together by the end of the 90s, and especially after the 9/11 terror attacks, both of which are really about the sort of long-term effects of the end of the Cold War. That one of them is that Hitchens has sort of lost faith in the socialist project, that even though he was never a supporter of you know, the Soviet model of, you know, what a, you know, post-capitalist society would look like, and he wouldn't even think of it that way exactly. It's still true, I think, that when the Cold War was going on, when so much of global politics was defined by this clash between systems, the sort of basic questions about how to organize a society felt like they were on the table, that they were like being meaningfully contested. And even if your position was door number three, right? You know, none of the above, that still felt like a sort of live position in a way that it really didn't in the 90s. I mean, the 90s is a time of like, in fact, it's kind of hard to remember now, you know, but like just tremendous ideological triumphalism, you know, that Francis Fukuyama wrote a book called The End of History that sort of, you know, which, you know, very few people read the book, but, you know, the title sort of sloganeeringly kind of summed up the way a lot of people felt about this, that, of course, there would still be historical events, but like the sort of big questions about how to organize a society were just over. Liberal capitalism had won, and the old, you know, you just had to sort out the details now. You know, Margaret Thatcher in the UK, you know, had this famous phrase, you know, Tina, there is no alternative, that they're just like this advanced kind of rapacious neoliberal capitalism, you know, that we had that was just it. That's all that was on the table. You know, she famously said once that she was asked what her greatest accomplishment was, and she said New Labor, meaning that the Labor Party drifted in her direction economically. You know, it's like really the
sort of Tony Blair.
Yeah, Tony Blair, exactly. Yeah, deepest side of her of her ideological triumph, you know. And so under these circumstances, I mean, calling yourself a socialist in Washington, D.C. in the 90s, it was like, I don't know, you know, you might as well it's like almost like a charming eccentricity, right? You know, you might as well say like I'm a supporter of the restoration of the Bourbon dynasty in France. You know, it's like, oh, okay, right? You know, good luck with that, right? And I think over the course of the 90s, he has Hitchens sort of, even though he's like rhetorically, right, you know, he's still saying oftentimes even very radical socialist things. I think as he sort of admitted when he reflected back on it later in his life, I think he sort of had a harder and harder time taking it seriously as like a live, viable political possibility. That, you know, he actually admits in Hitch 22 that, you know, he always used to go on you know, PBS, and the host would ask him, oh, Christopher, are you still a socialist? And like half the reason he was still saying yes is because he didn't want to give that guy the satisfaction of saying no, right? Like it just goes, and by the time he writes Letters to a Young Contrarian, which is actually pre-9/11, it comes out like a month after 9/11 or something, right? But I think it comes out maybe on 9/11. Anyway, it's like right around when that happens, but certainly written before. Letters to a Young Contrarian, he basically says, look, I don't like the kind of unrestrained, rapacious monopoly capitalism we have. I hope we could find some way to restrain its excesses, but the historical moment is over, right? We're not going to have socialism. So that's one thread. And then the other thread is just, look, he spent all this time as a globetrotting journalist over the decades, spending time in countries like, for example, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and befriending local dissidents, and presumably, certainly as a young Trotskyist in the 70s, he thought that, you know, some future wave of global socialist revolutions would sweep all of these regimes into the dustbin of history. And, you know, maybe there's some degree of some version of that that he was still holding out hope for later. But by the time he's sort of fully admitted to himself that that's just not going to happen, at least he wants to hold out hope for some kind of democratic revolution if socialist revolution is off the table. And this is the exact point in this chain of reasoning where I can retain sympathy for what he's saying. And here's where I lose it, you know, that sort of says, okay, well, what's the force in the world that has the power to bring about these democratic revolutions? It's the 82nd Airborne, you know, it's the US, you know, sending the Marines. And I think that, I guess the last thing I would say about this is just, you know, both of these factors are about sort of post-Cold War disorientation. And I think it is really important that the kinds of wars that the United States are fighting do seem at least superficially really different. That, in other words, look, I think that there's a pretty considerable echo of the Nixon-Kissinger approach to Cambodia in like the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad. I think that there's, I think that, the sort of pretensions of being interested in spreading, democracy, mean about as much in these later wars as they do in the Cold War. The regime where, as awful as it is that Afghanistan is ruled by the Taliban again, it's, maybe the worst government in the world, but, social progress in Afghanistan would have to come from within that society, trying to impose it from outside. I mean, like that had the government we were propping up by the end had about as much popular support as the government of South Vietnam, and with very similar results, right? So I would see much more continuity, but I think from Hitchens's perspective, so much of what he hated the most about, like what Reagan, for example, was doing in the 80s, was that we were propping up these right wing dictators, and death squads in Latin America. And if George W. Bush had been fighting wars against like peasant communist revolutionaries, like LBJ had in Vietnam, or like Reagan had in Nicaragua, for that matter, in a way, right? And then I don't think Hitchens ever would have been able to bring himself to support that. But I think when he starts to see the kinds of enemies we're fighting in the 90s and 2000s, I mean, Slobodan Milosevic and this like right-wing ethno-nationalist government in Serbia, the Taliban in Afghanistan, Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party in Iraq, he'd say, look, which do these look more like? The kinds of peasant communist revolutionaries being fought against in previous American wars, or exactly the kind of forces that the United States was propping up all around the world in this era. So if the, if the empire is going to, is going to, like there's a point actually in a debate that he did in the 2000s, with his brother, Peter Hitchens, who's a really interesting character. Cause he's like he's like the photographic negative of Christopher, because he's like very deeply religious and a conservative, but also kind of an isolationist about foreign policy. In this debate with Christopher, with Peter it's like 2008 or something in Grand Rapids, there's a questioner who asks him, would you now admit that our adventure in Iraq has been imperial? And he was like, yeah, of course. But the United States was also an empire when it was supporting Saddam Hussein, right? At least now, right? It's sort of, using that imperial power on the right side is his analysis. I think that I would just say as my editorial comment that the last couple of decades have rendered pretty decisive judgment on that.
Right. Well, there's so much more to talk about your book, but we have run out of time. So I want to thank you so much for taking your time to share your thoughts with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.